Now we are really live, not just pretending. This is David Rovix back on the internet here for another episode of Discussions with David, which comes to you in one form or another on these days, most weekday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific, or weekday afternoons if you're on the East Coast, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and 6 p.m. GMT most of the year. And where I talk with somebody for an hour about what they're up to and what they've been up to, what they might be up to in the future, and that sort of thing. And it all goes out on in video form on various places: Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Twitch. We're on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio, among other places, and it will go as a podcast afterwards if you look up This Week with David Rovix wherever you get your podcasts. And today we are very happy to be spending the hour with Laura Marie River Victor Peace, who is a wonderful activist and I guess we don't say blogger now, but the zines, these are physical zines. I was just about to call her a blog. She may be a blogger, but fantastic writer of poetry and all sorts of other thoughts, and activist around mental health activism and other forms of activism in Las Vegas, Nevada, at a house I've been to many times, a radical compound of a sort. Laura Marie, great to have you here with
us. Thank you, David.
I would just sort of a little bit of context for people, at least for in my mind and perhaps others. The police are continually killing people on the streets of this country. And, some of the main reasons that people get killed include having black or brown skin. But another major reason that people are being killed of all races and genders is for having mental health crises in the streets. And this just happened several days ago here in Portland in Lentz Park. And I know that is kind of I wanted to start there, although that's very much the present. But I want to go back to your beginnings in terms of this particular mental health activism, because it began for you with an identical occurrence in Las Vegas, I believe.
Yes, well, the Las Vegas Radical Mental Health Collective began in 2017. There, I had actually been trying to make an Icarus Project group there for a couple of years, but in 2017...
What's the Icarus Project? I've heard of it, but...
The Icarus Project was one of the first radical mental health groups started by Sasha and Jax a while back, and the tagline, I guess, was... the idea of Icarus is like flying too close to the sun, and you know, the desire for that brightness, but then the danger of that brightness. It's had to do with dangerous gifts and like reframing mental health struggles as dangerous gifts and like things that could be, you know, difficult but manageable, and the creativity that we can have, and just the good parts as well as the struggly parts.
Right.
But that was part of what saved me when I was first diagnosed with bipolar 1. With psychotic features about 14 years ago. So yeah, the Icarus Project helped me see that I had a lot of options besides what like mainstream medicine and big pharma were trying to feed me. Mm. So I loved Icarus Project for a long time and wanted to start a group in Las Vegas. And I was having some trouble with meeting spaces and organizing stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in 2017, when there was a man in Las Vegas named Tashi Brown who got murdered by the cops. And then there was this artist named Ravi Zupa. And Ravi Zupa wanted to contribute to Las Vegas, the well-being of the people in Las Vegas, by giving a chunk of money toward kind of like learning how to do de-escalation stuff in hopes that more people wouldn't get killed by cops. And so he gave that chunk of, must have contacted like the Food Not Bombs in Las Vegas. And then some of our friends in Food Not Bombs were like, hey, there's this chunk of money. Let's do this street medic training. So then my spouse Ming started that street medics group that year. And then I gave up on the Icarus and made it instead be like the Radical Mental Health Collective. But yeah, Tashi Brown had was having a crisis, and he was scared, and he was running, and he asked some cops for help, and they, you know, they chased him and they killed him, and he was a Black man, and he was having, you know, an emotional crisis that later was related to drugs also. And so it was really an honor to take this gift from this artist to help form this Radical Mental Health Collective. And then we did the de-escalation training, and then a lot of things have happened since then, but the Radical Mental Health Collective has been going since May of 2017.
That's fantastic. And can you talk about some of the work that I'm curious about the de-escalation work and how that has gone, and sort of efforts at applying the techniques. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I've seen de-escalation done so well by people without any formal training on the streets of Portland. And I've also seen it done so badly by people with formal training. So it's kind of, what's been your experience with that?
That's a good question. We did that training. I learned a lot in the research for that. And then some of those skills from that training were folded into like the meetings that the collective has in general. So kind of the mission of the collective in general. It's like a multi-mission, but one of them is just, you know, we meet twice a month for regular meetings, but then there are other kind of workshops and stuff too. Mm-hmm. But those are about kind of like building emotional skills and building relationship skills and relating in a healthy way, even if for just that, you know, hour and a half of time. And then hopefully like that well-being and that, those things we learn how to do can kind of inform a happier self and a happier way of doing relationship, and then carry over into like the rest of our lives. So I feel like it's kind of this intentionality about like, you know, showing up with kind curiosity, showing up with patience, showing up with kind intent, and relating in this like safer way that is a pleasure. And then what we learn from that, we can take into the rest of our lives. So it's not as much, we started with the intent of putting on a lot of de-escalation trainings, and then it changed over the years into something that's more, that philosophy and worldview and MO is kind of like just folded into it.
You know, there's a book I encountered a long time ago. I guess when I was a kid, and I don't think I ever read it, but the title was so good, by Eric Fromm, about being sane in an insane world. and it was just like, I mean, when I think about people on the streets, especially, you know, living in tents and having mental health crises, I can't imagine why you wouldn't have a mental health crisis if you're living in a tent. And the way that this has become so normalized in the minds of so much of the middle class, like they completely dehumanize people who live on the streets. I hear it, people talking about the houseless all the time, walking down the sidewalk, the way, like, you know, middle class white people especially will tend to talk about them, like, you know, really in using terms that are really dehumanizing and really unintentionally, it seems like they're just doing it without even thinking about it. But
yes,
what do you got some thoughts about being sane in an insane world, or insane in a sane world, or whatever, insane in an insane world, or how we understand these terms?
Yeah, I do. I think that, yeah, when I hear people talk about people who live on the streets as not really human, I think that it has to do with like the pain that they see in those people, and they can't engage that pain and really be there with those people. So it's necessary to dismiss their humanity. So it's not this like, so their own wound doesn't hurt them for, you know, knowing that could be them and that could be their kid or whatever. But what are you saying about the, cause I identify as crazy. I like the word crazy.
Great.
And I feel like being considered crazy is an honor because to me that means I'm seeing the things that others won't see or won't admit they see, and also just like having more dimension to things is nice. I have a friend who would refer to his mental health issues as like he's a house and the windows are open and there are no screens and a lot of birds and kites and pollen and clouds are flying in. And so, you know, it's a rich, beautiful life with so much, you know, in my house, but it's also like pretty difficult at times. And, you know, maybe I don't want all those birds, but I need the eggs. So I like to see it that way.
I love it.
But also a lot of creativity and a lot of, It's a blessing to be able to have a vision that that is special, and I feel like that's a cool role in society too. Like if that's what I'm doing as a disabled person, and I'm not working a regular job, my job is to speak my truth and heal my trauma, and you know connect and make community. So in a way, that's all an honor, even though the government didn't say, "Here's your you know little tiny check." I'm honoring you. The government said, you know, I hope you'll die so I don't have to keep paying your health insurance. But I could kind of like reframe it myself.
Reinterpret that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's much better.
Yeah, that's my role in this world, and I love that role. So I'm very happy with it.
Talk about that the pros and cons idea, that like the advantages. Because, I mean, one thing that occurs to me is I don't think that it is possibly a coincidence that such a largely disproportionate number of the most brilliant artists in history have been considered crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also it also occurs to me that, you know, sometimes when I see people trying to relate to, you know, when I see professionals, you know, trying to relate to people that are considered crazy, I think, you know, I feel like I have a really advantage just from all the experience I've had with hallucinogenic drugs, because I think that when you do acid, you get to experience temporarily experience something along the lines of a schizophrenic state.
Sure.
Which is, I think, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, and you can see why it would be a very difficult reality to live in, but to be in there for a few hours is absolutely, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to learn from it, and you know, even though it can be very scary too.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not really a question so much as just a bunch of rambling, and I'm just looking for your rambling in response.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. Well, I always felt like I didn't need to do shrooms or acid or any of those, since I've heard voices all my life.
Yeah.
And I felt, there have been times that I wanted to try it, and then I was like, I'm working so hard to like minimize this. Why would I take these things to intentionally? Yes. So I never did that, but I feel like I never needed to.
No, I wouldn't say, I would say you're already there. You don't need it. Yeah. You don't need the help. Yeah.
But as for like mental health professionals and how they treat people like me, yeah, the power dynamic when I walk into, or actually I'm in the room scared by myself usually. And then the professional walks in, and then the power dynamic that I feel is really creepy, that I'm like immediately like incompetent, stupid, not having worth. You know, he doesn't believe I can even be happy. He doesn't believe I can even have a good life. And he's like full of assumptions of what my life is. Mm-hmm. So it's very like starting off with that much wrong, like how much work would that be to like climb out of the wrongness hole of that situation, right, and like get to some truth where that doctor can really see me and really see what I need and believe in, and believe in me that I could, have a good life, which I really believe my life is much better than his, right. You know, because I, you know, I have this freedom and I have this joy, and I'm not like trapped in the little world that he needs to feel safe in. So.
Yeah. What is the little world that they, I mean, what is the, no, I mean, like the idea that a lot of the professionals have that there is this kind of normative reality that is better. Right. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, but then you look around at our society and mm-hmm. how can anybody, I mean, does anybody really think that's that normative reality is good? I mean, when you think about how many people are working their asses off in jobs they hate and how much, how that affects their mental health.
Oh, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. how much is just really shitty jobs? How much does that contribute to the overall level of depression and anxiety and suicide in this country?
Oh, God. Yeah. I met someone who she said she would have a panic attack in her car before work every morning. Right. And I'm like, I'm looking at her and I'm like, what could be worse that yeah. like it's so sad to have made this world where, yeah, where like they, that people could really believe that in order to preserve this, you know, security and illusion of security and whatever they got going, they have to like sacrifice their whole well-being for this other, like for like a monetary well-being or a perceived monetary well-being that could disappear in a second anyway. So it's bizarre that of all the worlds we created that one. But
was there a point in your life where, mm-hmm. where you, was there like a moment where you realized like, oh, this whole idea that I'm crazy and they're sane and this whole diagnosis thing, and there's, it's really serious mm-hmm. problems with this whole model. was there a particular yeah. point, or was it a gradual thing, or did you already figure it out really early on that you were that there was something really messed up with the whole structure?
Yeah, I would say that was pretty clear to me from a young age. But I remember, you know, when I was being diagnosed as bipolar 1, you know, having my first full-blown manic episode and being told these things about myself that were really painful. And a lot of work to untell myself over the next few years. mm-hmm. But, you know, showing up at this sad, sad poverty clinic and being shuffled from room to room and fill out this form and this and this and this. And all the, like, soul crushing, like, there was no nourishment there. There was no beauty there. Mm-hmm. It was just like, this is your last resort. Sorry about this helicopter.
Oh, no problem. Helicopters. If you got a helicopter overhead, it's a sign that you're doing something right. You know, especially if it just stays there. You know, if it just hovers.
It's moving on. But
it's moving on. So you got to work a little harder. Yeah.
But yeah, the complete lack of like joy or beauty or kindness or humanity. You know, the forms had been photocopied so many times, David, that the lines were like dotted lines and they weren't straight on the page. They were all crooked. And it was just like, really, my name and address again, all to be prescribed these pills that I was given through a bulletproof glass from a little, you know, because the people are so mad at how they're being treated. Like everyone, mm-hmm. almost everyone in there is furious because they're not being treated as a human by people who aren't acting like humans. And, you know, it's just pain. It's like pain on top of pain. So just to, like, avoid that as much as I can is my goal, which is part of why, like, radical mental health is so important to me as one of the tools in my toolbox. Because if I can have, like, these 20 good tools that I don't have to resort to that really crappy tool of that pain clinic, you know.
That's right. Yeah. That's something you've written about recently is this toolbox. And I think that would be of great interest and value to a lot of other people. Can we go through some of those tools in the toolbox?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. So the radical mental health is good. I like the embodied healing, like the ecstatic dance, the trike riding, the qigong, and other ways of like healing my whole self, including the physical self with all the stuff that's inside, you know, the feelings of my whole self. Because I feel like the whole model, I was fed such a wrong model about like, oh, your emotions are like in your head or your heart, when of course they're in our whole bodies. And mm-hmm. then other tools would be like, The community building, the helping others, you know, like feeding people who are hungry, the activism, like having a meaningful life, that was just a whole difference, really. Like when I came to Nevada.
Talk about that a little more, would you? Like how has that affected? I mean, yeah. I tell people this all the time, but I want to hear in your words. Like, I mean, I tell people, and I think a lot of people say this, that I think one of the best ways to, that's sort of therapeutic for yourself is to actually help others, which to a lot of people who haven't tried it, I think it sounds counterintuitive. But your experience is that it's true.
Yeah, I've heard people who think like, I only have a little energy. I need it all for myself. And exactly. You can create energy and you could create, you know, creating like the connection is enough. You know, that's something you could live for. I mean, that's what I'm on earth to do. Like one of the main things. So like to be alone in your apartment, hiding and pretending that the rest of the world doesn't exist, or you're not responsible for anyone but yourself, or that money can keep you safe, or whatever, like false thing, you know, is not gonna like enliven you and make you want to live and do, you know, it's like so much happier to connect and try to help and to step outside and contribute to sharing. Cause I feel like the sharing, I feel like capitalism wants us in our own little places with all of our own like cookie sheets and like lawnmowers and, you know, like all of our own things when there's so much more that we could do if we were sharing all of that.
Mm-hmm. Here, here. And do you do blogging online or do you in principle or just preference only do print zines?
Yes.
What's that? Which one?
No, I've been blogging every day since 2006.
Okay.
I've been blogging every day since 2006, so that's in addition to all of the zines that I make.
Yeah, that's great. So you do both, but the zines are. So what made you? I'm curious. I'm always curious about people in the modern age. 25 mm-hmm. years into the internet, and everybody, most people having an email account and stuff like that. What the decision to continue to make zines, first of all, before talking about the contents a little more, what was that about? What makes you want to do these? I love them and they're wonderfully simple, just pieces, just like regular sized pieces of paper folded and stapled, like the most standard, like classic zine format.
Oh, those are sewn, David.
Oh, they're sewn.
The binding is sewn. but I hear you.
Oh my goodness.
It's very.
Oh my goodness! It is actually sewn. Excuse me, that is not a staple. Those are sewn. Oh my goodness! I hadn't even seen that. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, very well sewn too. It like behaves like a staple. You know, it's solid.
So
my powers of
I guess that's before the 25 years you cite, David. I think it's a bad habit, and it's also, you know, fun to trade through the mail. I have a lot of pen pals. And I'm friends with a lot of other zinesters, so we like to send them to each other. It's just fun. And I like to create a physical thing. And I like, you know, I like to make the art now or get someone else to make the art. And it's beautiful to have a physical thing to hand someone with love or to leave, you know, like at a bus stop or, you know, in a cafe or whatever, in a Airbnb or wherever you want to leave things in a library. But Yeah, it's joyful, and it's joyful to have it arranged as like a small thing, like as opposed to like a book that for me can feel like really intense. Like a book can feel like too intense, and the zine has like a little informality and ephemeral quality that is nice, that it's very, very valuable to the point of priceless at times, but also kind of like not worth much, and you could kind of throw it over there. So it could be both at the same time. I like that.
And do you find that?
But then the blogging is, the blogging is easier to share in a way. The digitalness, the quickness, instantaneousness, and it's cheaper. Well, sometimes it's kind of cheaper too, because all the photocopying and posting.
But with the zine phenomenon, do you have that you end up having some kind of a connection with random people in different places who are putting out zines, and that becomes a bit of a scene in itself? I'm not sure if you're having trouble hearing because the connection is a little spotty at the moment, and there's a big delay.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And there are zine fests. Ming and I traveled to the one in the Bay Area a couple years ago. That really wonderful. Uh-oh. Should I go? Maybe I don't even know where the router is here. Should I? I could try to go inside.
Actually, it's okay. Now you're coming through fine. It's just there's about a 5-second delay.
Sorry, David. The connection's been good this whole time. We've been here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's okay. The delay is fine.
Now to air.
Laura Marie, can I ask you about this this zine?
Oh, weird.
It's a huge delay. So just wait for the answer. I'll wait for the answer. It's like satellite phones or something. But this one zine, to love abusers in radical spaces, to love : abusers in radical spaces, and you write about things that I think are so extremely relevant to a lot of people in lots of different activist scenes around the world, where they're. There's a lot of questions about what do you do, how do you deal with people who are in one way or another, whether it's abusive or microaggressions or somebody thinks somebody else is anti-Semitic or sexist or transphobic or whatever it is, then these accusations are made, or these problems are happening within a community. And then what often happens is there's some elements in the community who are like, oh, that person needs to be exiled. We need to have nothing to do with that person, which and maybe that's sometimes appropriate. I don't know. But I want to get your take on that whole reality. And I'm just going to, because of the 5-second delay, I'm just going to stop talking and let you talk. So if there's silence, it's not because I'm just going to be quiet and listening for a while because of the delay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for asking about that, David. I think that I liked to believe that when I went into a radical space where I was with people who had values that had a lot in common with mine, I would be safe. And nobody was going to hurt me there or abuse me there, because we were on the same page with so much of what we believed and what we needed. And when I learned that going into a space like that, I could be abused just as harshly as anywhere else, that was a sad thing to learn. I really wished to be safe in these places. And I thought if we were like feeding hungry people, like, wow, we're like doing this great thing. Yeah, we could do this. We could be kind to each other. We could help the world. And then, or with radical mental health or street medic stuff or any, IWW, anything like that we were doing in community, I really didn't want that harm there. So I was really surprised and really sad when there was that harm there, and sometimes more than in other spaces. And it seemed like, especially with radical mental health, like we're intentionally creating a place where we can be really vulnerable, and some people are gonna take advantage of that, and some people are gonna like specifically seek out the vulnerable people to hurt, which is like not a truth I enjoy, But here we have it, and we have to learn how to like handle that and negotiate it and negotiate the needs of all the people involved and what's truth and how do we decide what's truth and what's appropriate responses. And yeah, and the question of like pushing someone out, like if we push them out, where do they go? They just go to another place to do the same. And what is healing? What is redemption or resolution, or, you know, thinking about transformative and restorative justice and the you know, obviously the criminal, the system we have with the prison industrial complex is not a system that's working out. So, you know, and if we're anarchists and if we aren't going to call the cops, who are we going to call? What are we going to do? And it seemed like we were starting from square one in so many. Oh, well, the way I've been thinking about it is there's kind of like the punitive model, you know, with the prison industrial complex. There's kind of a restorative where there's an attempt to do something deeper and more like actually based on reality and what could actually help people. And then like the transformative was like taking it, trying to like not just look at this micro situation, but to look at a, you know, macro and like how to help the community and world as a whole with this like kind of thing. So just so anything besides that first like punitive motto would be something where the humanity is considered, where the feelings are considered, where the actual needs of the actual people and like facing the systems that contributed to the problem, you know, facing the economic stuff, the racial stuff, the mental health stuff too. And like, where did it come from? And then like what is actually best for everyone here, as opposed to just like, what's the official policy or what is the punishment that's normal just doing something that's more real, I guess. But even then, like, to me, that's still kind of like a dream, because what I really having, you know, in my everyday life and community in Las Vegas, the power struggles. Yeah, it can be such a what? Like, because it seems like a lot of times a bully is going to want to take over. You know, when there are questions like this, who is going to step up and be like, this is a problem, we need to solve it? It's going to be someone who might have a lot of motivations behind what they're doing to step up and try to solve it. So it's kind of, sometimes it can feel like dodging an abuser, and like an abuser who's doing things under the table, than a bully who's doing things over the table. And then a bunch of scared people who don't know what to think, the victims, the accused. It's just like a bunch of or a lot of times the bully will have people who will say one thing to the bully's face and then one thing to everyone else. But once it starts feeling like witch huntish, where like, oh, that person was associated with that person, so now we don't like them either, and then like the guilty by association gets bigger and bigger, then after a while it could just feel like I need to move to a new town. Like I can't do this anymore, but I know that this is what humans are like, so I gotta figure this out. And moving to a new town is not going to solve it, because it's going to happen there too, because it's not really about like if I did wrong, it's about if I sat next to someone too long who did wrong. Or And the way that the truth is decided is so weird. When communication is something people are that terrified of, that they're not going to want to talk about what really happened, so they'll assume and bolt, usually. Or, you know, suddenly like, oh, I haven't heard from so-and-so in a while, I guess they decided, you know, such and such. So that is very weird, the way it can feel to be implicated in anything like that. But I feel like hopefully when we're like learning how to be more honest about relationship and emotions, then, you know, we could talk about stuff better. And then hopefully we could be real with each other enough to say the truth and be brave enough to say the truth. And that's like at least a good start with all of that.
Yeah, that sounds really good. And I wonder when you're talking about trying to communicate and the the assumptions that get made and the lack of of actually describing what really happened because for whatever combination of reasons people don't want to talk about it and then like how that gets complicated even more by social media and social media algorithms and you talk about is that a particular area of horror or fascination what social media does to all that?
That's an interesting train wreck to watch, but I think that the way that I want to use social media is not that way. You know, like I don't want to play with that. I just go on there to like post my things and like connect with people who I love. But I know what you're talking about, an issue can get magnified depending on how the algorithm chooses to like display it to who and how like that like drama thing seems like intentionally like part of it. I remember seeing things like that. But a lot of times I'm the kind of person who will, you know, I didn't go to that party where that thing happened and I missed that post where that person said that. So in a lot of ways I'm just kind of like focus on the healing part of it more than that messier, like there's something appealing to a lot of people about the way it can feel so important. Like all of a sudden this thing happens, like, and if you're involved, like suddenly you're important and your input's important and your perspective's important, but it's just kind of artificial and it's just kind of going to pass in a couple of weeks probably. But I would rather cultivate like an importance that's more like steady and long term than like that drama importance thing.
So I love the way, Laura Marie, you own these different kinds of terms. Like you refer to yourself as a trike slut, and in one of your zines, and you describe your trike trips around town, and I just wonder, like, I mean, riding a trike around Las Vegas in the course of 2020, in the course of this pandemic, I mean, Las Vegas is a extremely divided city between rich and poor, and there's a hell of a lot of dire poverty in that city. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, you know, I'm not trying to ask a leading question. It's just one of the things I notice when I'm in, especially certain neighborhoods of Las Vegas, like the number of people living on the streets. But what I wonder if you could just tell us about your general impressions or any stories you got from riding a trike around Las Vegas at 6 a.m.
Oh, yeah. We have to go at the dawn hour during the summer. We could go other hours the rest of the year. But we mostly stick to our own neighborhood, which is in the historic West Side. And our neighborhood is very, very beautiful. It's my favorite place I've ever lived. I love the trash. There's trash everywhere. And I like to look at it as I pass by. And I love the broken glass that glitters. It glitters and sparkles with beauty everywhere I look. And I love the neighbors. And I love watching the people in the morning who are walking home from wherever they were in yesterday's clothes. And I love, you know, the pigeons and everything I see in the gutter. I made a term. The term is guttermancy, where I like to look in the gutter and I see, like, what my culture left for me there. And I see the beauty of that trash, because some of it is amazing, you know, the broken chairs, the old sinks, all those tires, the pallets. I love pallets. You know, the mattresses of the dead, the traffic cones. The traffic cones that got liberated from the traffic cone people, or, you know, and just the notes, the threatening notes someone left on someone's car that blew away. Or, you know, there's often like a Starbucks card that could have something on it, but it usually doesn't. Mostly they're keys, like those card keys for the hotels. I see a lot of those. But Anyway, these trike rides are very beautiful. And oh yeah, we found that pool that one time. It was a kiddie pool, that a hot pink kiddie pool that was cracked. So we took it home to make a garden bed out of it, a raised bed out of the kiddie pool. And I was carrying it on my trike, and it was kind of like a wing, like a pink wing that was flying with me. It was a beautiful day to get to that kiddie pool, but we try not to pick too much up, but but the neighbors are nice. And you know what? Like in this neighborhood, what you see is what you get. This wasn't built on the backs. You know, this isn't like a facade of bullshit built on the backs of oppressed people. This is oppressed people building their own thing that's not a facade, that is falling apart and crumbling right before your eyes. And half the houses are boarded up with something spray painted on them, like no trespassing or whatever is spray painted. And it's beautiful.
There's a huge number of boarded up abandoned housing in Las Vegas, isn't there? It's like one of the biggest cities in the country for having vacant housing. Huh? Is there much of a squatting effort going on at all?
I don't see much of it. I wonder sometimes, but no, I don't see much. But yes, it's amazing to see all the empty houses in our neighborhood. And then all of the fresh McMansions they're building over by Red Rock that are worth, you know, whatever, I don't know, $1 million. I don't know. But it's bizarre. Like, wait, there's all these houses over here, but nobody wants those houses. But some of them are really beautiful. I love this neighborhood. You know, I feel so at home there. I feel like, like it's real. Sorry, David.
Yeah, no, it's the delay. A friend of mine in New Orleans would talk about how early on a Sunday morning was the most interesting time of the week, because that's when all the folks who were out partying all Saturday night were dragging themselves home and passing all the church-going families dressed up in their Sunday best. And would you say that early Sunday morning is an especially interesting time?
Sundays are pretty amazing in our neighborhood, because our neighborhood is dense with churches. Like a lot of Black people live in this neighborhood, but then a lot of Black people moved away and come back for these specific churches. So the streets will be covered in parked cars that aren't normally there. And then I could hear, sometimes when I pass, I could hear someone preaching in there really loudly. And it seemed like these services go on for a long, long time. So it's not early morning. It's more like a little later, I think it starts, but it could go through noon, I think. And so it's, you know, it changed. That stopped with the COVID, but then it's starting up again. And it's really fun to see that, but it's also more traffic that I have to dodge on my trike. So in a way, I have to be more careful at those stop signs.
Do you have any particular plans or aspirations for the post-pandemic period that is at least theoretically coming?
We're going to start meeting in person again for the Radical Mental Health Collective. So that means we can share snacks again and juice, and we can write in the purple sketchbook together again and hug people. That will be really, really great. That's probably like the main plan, other than like physical contact. I really look forward to that. And I want to go to the coast, to my homeland, and see.
Where is that?
My aunt. I come from Santa Maria, California. So I was born in Lompoc near Vandenberg Air Force Base. I want to go over there and see my peeps over there. And my mom died just over a year ago, so I want to go where her ashes are scattered and just see my homeland again and smell those special smells over there.
Does it smell like eucalyptus?
How did you know, David? And the ocean and the eucalyptus, and then a little bit souther in Santa Barbara, where I went to school, there's a lot of anise growing, the wild anise. So you could smell like the eucalyptus plus anise plus sea spray coming from the water.
Okay.
That's like my one of my very favorite smells. Yeah. Oh, I studied literature at the College of Creative Studies. And then I went down to UC Irvine for the poetry MFA.
So there's some explanation for that, your talent in that particular area. Do you have any poems handy that you might be able to give us?
Oh, a poem right now.
Am I putting you on the spot? You don't have anything out there ready to read or anything, do you?
Oh, sure. Sure I do.
I didn't ask you about that before.
But it would take me a second. It would take me a second to find it. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. You just take a second. No problem. And we'll just let people know you're listening to Discussions with David, which you can find archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix. And in podcast form, if you look for This Week with David Rovix, wherever you get your podcasts. This Friday, I'll be interviewing songwriter, musician from England, Frank Turner. There's your non-commercial announcement.
Very good. I liked that one.
You like that announcement?
It's so soothing. Yes, it sounds so soothing.
The radio thing, you know, and speaking quietly into a nice mic. You know, I've been working at that for years. Ever since I first heard those songwriters whispering into their mics, and I thought, oh yeah, microphone technique. I like that.
Yes, the intimacy of that radio.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a poem called Hospital I'd like to read for you, David.
Excellent.
Could I do that one?
Please.
It's a bit disturbing at times. Pardon?
I'll do the solo layout for real performance poetry.
Oh, nice. Okay. Hospital. The blue door with handrails made of metal pipes painted white, a hand can grasp. Walking up the concrete stairs. What's behind there? Suffering. You come here because there are no other options. Your family can no longer take what you're doing. No one loves you right, so you're driven to the hospital. The lawn no one walks on, the doorway no one lingers in. You are rushed through. They could pretend you have freedom before you're in. But once in, you are no longer a person. You are a role, and how well you play your role determines how long you're a prisoner. But that moment you step out of the car, the blue door could mean other possibilities. What if they respected you? Kind words, a smile, gentle hand on your arm one moment, a delicious food part of your breakfast. It doesn't have to be sedation, abuse, half alive again in group, how well you fawn to the psychiatrist who comes through, important, making decisions in a bad mood. The blue door will lock behind you. When you exit because the insurance ran out or someone decided you're well, you will step another place. You'll be moving forth toward outdoor air and light. You won't care about that door letting you toward freedom, but you understand what can be taken from you at any time. 2, learning to trust outdoors again. Pretend that didn't happen. You are a crazy person, they would defend, but you know what role was assigned is almost arbitrary. Push anyone enough and they will not be fine. Try to make a better family who will not give up on you. Heal the torn places with mediated, calm conversations. Forgive these gestures and rituals, crying hugs, a promise for truth. Try to find safe places your spirit can rest near the earth. Heal something that makes you periodically shine too harshly, hurting everyone's eyes. You had some weird ideas for a while. It's okay now. But you're like a kid who goes to jail. Now judges know you're that kind of person who can get sent where they put people othered into seclusion rooms and sharp things removed from who doesn't have power. Those with power are getting paid and can have any sharp thing. 3, they go home at shift's end and treat their family like normal. You are not my patient. You are my kid, partner, or pet. I am not that person who pushed a med cart, restrains, slings mashed potatoes accurately in the right tray rectangle. I am not a jail warden. I am not checking under your tongue or waiting for you to swallow the water. I am not injecting something into someone who resists being injected. The blue door is for them, has behind it where they toil and are judged on a different scale, paid to harm in an effort to help some sad, messed up people and afford a house, feed and clothe the family they assembled. They sacrifice their soul there in order to care well for relatives who will hopefully never need hospitals like this. My kid is sleeping safely at home. She has a nice bed I bought and will never be denied sheets. Privacy to pee, her essential freedom. Calmly happy with cartoons and chicken nuggets she likes, we will keep her safe at any cost. But you can't control what makes her eventually go crazy. She slips towards self-harm and other violence while you work a double shift. The overtime will really help. But you're falling asleep when she's whispered about. They decide she has to go to a different hospital where you've never worked. You pray they don't do to her what you've done to everyone. 4 is almost done. It's more like a movie where don't step through that door. You will never be the same. The mansion is obviously haunted. We came here for that purpose. The blue door has so much behind it, I'm surprised it can even close. It's a cartoon door now, bulging out, stuck to the wall by its hinges and where it closes. Its edges are curved from the force of everything pressed up, struggling to escape. To go home, if home is possible.
Ah, that's fantastic, Laura Marie. Gosh, are you a fan of Ken Kesey?
No, I don't know who is Ken Kesey.
Oh, the author of the book "One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest."
No! I never read that. No.
I'm reminded of passages of in that book from your your poem. So I suspect you might like it. But that's wonderful. That's fantastic. So such great imagery, and it's so evocative. I mean, you just feel like you're there. That's fantastic.
Yeah, you're glad you're not, huh?
I'm really glad I'm not. Yeah, and the way you describe the workers, like, you know, the one who throws the potatoes into the, I mean, it all just, it's just such a surreal situation to be in when you realize that these are the people who are being considered normative, and you're the one who's supposed to have a problem, like within the, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very, and then. What if, I mean, I know you've been pretty isolated during the pandemic, and a lot of people, most people have been, and I wonder if you got any, I mean, it's kind of a cliche question at this point because it's kind of obvious, but can you talk about the impact of the pandemic on our brains in this planet? I know a lot of people who have completely lost their marbles in very bad ways during the pandemic.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I've been really isolated physically. I stopped going out and seeing people. I don't go to stores or anything. But I never was isolated, like, in the inner world, or, like, I always talk to people more through, like, writing letters or texts or emails anyway. So the vast majority of my socializing was already virtual. But as for how it's affected, so I already had all the skills that I needed to, like, endure a pandemic pretty much, because that was already kind of my life in a way. But then other people, yeah, I see them suffer, and my heart aches for them when they don't know how to be alone, or they don't like the company of their own minds. But you know, I reach out to them a little bit, but yeah, it didn't change much for me, really. I heard other people say everything changed, and I looked at them like, wow, really? Everything? But to them it did, yeah.
And did the pandemic in particular inspire any poetry from you?
Pandemic poetry. No, but I did think about. I did think about how nice it felt sometimes when I was on a Zoom and we went into breakout rooms, and then the other people would leave the breakout room and I'd be all by myself in that breakout room, and I would feel like the cozy aloneness in that breakout room. And that's an experience I never would have had if not for the pandemic. And I like to think of that as being in a breakout room of one's own.
I love it. And have you ever tried VR goggles before? Like those? No, I haven't either. But it sounds like a really interesting way to be in a Zoom room, or like to be in a room where you can actually walk around and, you know, hear people that are closer to you better than the ones who are further from you. But you're already accustomed to the internet. So adapting to Zoom meetings was, had you had Zoom meetings before the pandemic?
I don't think Zoom itself, but, you know, communicating online a lot, including, you know, like Skype-y kind of stuff, I've done.
Somebody on YouTube also likes the breakout room of one idea. I mean, this also could make a great chorus to a song. I mean, or at least a good poem. You know, I mean, if you haven't written a poem about being in a breakout room of one, I think that needs to be on the agenda. And
let's do it.
And so, like, when all the casinos and everything opens up back on the Strip, is that going to impact your life in any way? Or are you pretty much like sort of outside of that world? Or, I mean, does that impact your neighborhood in a big way?
Oh, David, they already did open. You know, they're already open.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm so out of it.
But as for my neighborhood. Yeah, the people who live in my neighborhood, you know, there's casinos for the locals. They're called, they're little, and they're not where the tourists go, really. I mean, it's like pretty separate, yeah. And a lot of the people who live where I live, they're not going to probably really go over there unless, you know. They're small, and they're in strip malls. There's like a Dottie's in like every strip mall. It's just got a bunch of slot machines and people smoking cigarettes and drinking beer in there. I don't know. It's like a bar, but like with a bunch of slot machines more. But I think they probably do like real gambling too, but I never go in there. I don't, you know, I don't gamble or drink or anything. So.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this whole sort of subculture, mini subcultures that I only sort of observe from the outside and have nothing to do with, but I'm still curious about it, but yeah. The casinos, local or big, I really never make it into them, except when I'm trying to take advantage of a cheap hotel. Yeah, because the hotels are cheap. For anybody passing through Las Vegas, you can often stay really cheaply in one of those casinos. They're hoping that you'll gamble, you know, of course.
Yeah, and eat at that big buffet they have and all that.
I got food poisoning last time I ate in a casino burger place in Las Vegas. But on that note,
I feel poisoned.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you, Laura Marie. Thank you so much for joining us on the show here on the internet.
Thank you for hearing me.
And I'll see you again. Hope to see you down in Las Vegas one of these post-vaccine days.
Yeah, see you in the desert.
Take care. And thanks, everybody, for joining in on this discussion with Laura Marie River Victor Peace from Las Vegas, Nevada, a brilliant poet and activist. And you can hear this this discussion archived at youtube.com/drovix or on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance or Kabu Community Radio's Facebook page. or in podcast form. It'll be up soon if you look for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Remember, mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent unless you really have to. Trust your neighbors. And hope to see you on Friday when I'll be talking to Frank Turner. Bye-bye for now.